Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Hi, this is Dick Staub, and I want to welcome you to the Kindling's Muse at the Movies, intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in today's movies. Over the next few minutes, we'll discuss some current releases, a few new DVD releases, and some classics that, according to our panelists and guests, every thoughtful film goer should see. Our guests are Jeffrey Overstreet, film critic, author of Aurelia's Colors and Through a Screen Darkly, Jenny Spohr, film producer, producer of The Kindling's Muse, and a reviewer with Past the Popcorn, and Greg Wright, managing editor of Hollywood Jesus and Past the Popcorn. You can look up these websites, if you're listening by podcast, at thekindlings.com. Well, it's good to have everybody back with us. Everybody doing a lot of movie going lately in the midst of life?
Oh, yes.
A question that people always ask is, how in the world do you squeeze movies in when you are as busy as all of you are? Very carefully? Is that the right answer?
Barely is sometimes the answer. Yeah.
Who needs sleep, really?
And I don't think any of us see as many as we would like to get to.
Yeah.
That's very
or
true.
The ones we want to.
Well,
to.
Yeah. Virtually every time we do this show, one of you is about ready to run off to a screening somewhere or just coming in from a screening. So for people that think that it's all just great fun, it's pretty hectic to try to get out to see all these movies. But fortunately, we have three people who get to see quite a few of them. We're going to start this show with The Other Boleyn Girl. Jenny, what's up?
Now, first off, I read the book, and it's always, oh, the book's better than the movie, but I've actually studied this period of history, so I'm a tough
critic. Wait a minute, you're about to say something that you actually know something about?
Exactly. A little
this
bit.
This is so rare for a film critic.
I studied Elizabeth more than I studied her father or her mother, but so I read the book, and it's... The book's not very historically accurate, but kind of a fun romp.
Yeah.
So I was expecting the same thing from the movie. It's about Anne and Mary Boleyn, of course, Anne being the second wife of Henry VIII, who gets her head lobbed off for various crimes, and many historians think none of which she committed. So as an Anglophile as well, someone that loves sort of these period pieces, it was hard for me to really finally embrace this movie because it was so far from the accuracy of history. And as a filmmaker, I think we should have the liberty to be able to put things, you know, into history, elaborate, make it more fun, but what they did with the film I don't think made it more fun. I didn't think it made it more interesting or suspenseful than actual history would have, which was really surprising. So they changed the book and they changed history and changed it for the worse, unfortunately. Natalie Portman and Scarlett Johansson do a very good job. Eric Bana is passing as King Henry, but... Yeah, unfortunately, disappointing, but we bring it up tonight to talk about history and how can you play with such famous people, especially from, I mean, if they were alive today, this would be sued for slander.
But I mean,
they're all
you've
over
got
the place.
Werner Herzog, who makes documentaries, saying there is no such thing as truth,
yeah.
And I don't intend, this is truth as I see it. So, I mean, there's kind of a trend in taking virtually anything and kind of turning it into a vehicle for what you wanted to say or do with it. And unfortunately, it sounds like that's what happened. Is that what you think about this film, Greg?
I think that the great tragedy of this film is the way in which it neuters the history of religion in the Western world, because the story of Henry VIII is one of the great stories of the Reformation. And the period is ripe for that. There have been some great movies that have dealt with that. In A Man for All Seasons, you find out that Henry VIII himself was a theologian of sorts and actually wrote theological treatises. So he has a thinking head on his shoulders and understands that what he's doing flies in the face of centuries of religious tradition. Even in a smaller film like Lady Jane that starred Helena Bonham Carter years ago, who was one of the successors to the throne for a few brief days, even her character exhibited the knowledge that the act that she was engaging in and assuming to the throne had something to do with the tension between the Protestant and Catholic churches. This film, it's like, oh, and incidentally, Henry's going to get a divorce, and this has something to do with the Pope, but we don't really care. and it's just baffling because it's like the history of Christendom in the Western world has just been neutered and rendered impotent.
Cliff Notes meets Mad Magazine meets film.
Bizarre.
It's kind of a weird retelling of history.
It's interesting to me that Barbara Nicolosi at Act One, Writing for Hollywood, on her blog, which is called Church of the Masses, she gives this film a recommendation because, you know, whatever it does to history, it still presents a simple morality tale that audiences need to hear. So she's recommending it.
Yeah, but this is back to what's the purpose of film. And, you know, if it meets my propagandist needs, it's a great film, you know, and that's not exactly where most of us come from.
Well, and even then, too, poor Anne gets just completely slandered. And so it really is. Yes. I mean, in actuality, she was not a witch. She did not sleep with her brother. All these things that she was accused of. Because Henry was moving on to Jane Seymour. Yeah, got to get rid of this one.
The era of feminism is evidently over.
Yeah.
You know, politically correct. And we're going to go the opposite direction now and fabricate. Well, anyway, we move on to another movie that's in theaters right now. 4 months, 3 weeks. And by the way, a lot of young women are going to be very disappointed with what you just said about this movie because they love to go to all of these films about that era, and it's disappointing when they go to one that's so bad.
Exactly, exactly.
4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days. Greg, what can you tell us about this movie?
Well, before we go any further, it would be incredibly disingenuous of me not to admit that in print I have declared that this film is one of the great overrated films of 2007.
We're just so on a roll downward, away from movie theaters everywhere. So much goes for our big sponsorship hopes from Regal Theaters, you know.
I am accountable for that opinion, but at the same time, that doesn't mean it's not a good film. It is a very good film. I just find that it's a film that's more interesting to talk about than watch. But that actually is a recommendation of sorts, because many of the films that we see these days, there's nothing to talk about after you watch them. In my review, I wrote that the cinema verite approach that the director uses doesn't exactly rub our nose in heartless facts, but it can try our patience. And I think that's the thing to just be aware of going into this film, which is a film that is very much about the choices that young women make in communist Romania during Soviet oppression, about how to manage their lives, in particular what to do with sex and what to do with pregnancy and what to do with abortion. And it's about a woman who becomes pregnant and seeks an illegal abortion and the lengths that she and her friend have to go to in order to carry this plan out.
Yeah.
And it's grim. I mean, this is very grim stuff. And so the approach taken is appropriate. And you're not going to make a comedy about this subject matter.
Well, except Juno.
Well,
so
very
how do you juxtapose Juno in this movie?
Because that is not a movie about abortion. That is a movie about a girl who is seeking to find hope.
Yeah.
In true love.
Yeah.
The fact that there is an unwanted pregnancy is almost incidental to the plot.
Right.
Here, it is the plot.
Yeah,
that's what this is about.
Yeah, okay.
And so it's grim.
And on top of that, 4 months is also about other things that people will do in the name of a transaction to get what they want and how that ends up demeaning everyone around them. I agree with Greg that this film will try your patience, but one of the things I love about it is that it respects the audience enough to ask us to step up and think these things through while we're watching. It does not give you any romantic soundtrack music to tell you when to cry because it's too complicated for that.
How would you guess, realizing there's guesswork here, that this film got made? I mean, first of all, you go to pitch this film, and what do you say that makes a film company greenlight it and say, yeah, let's make this movie?
Well, it takes place in Romania, and it's not an American movie. I mean, it's not like they went in and pitched it and a studio decided, okay, we'll go for it. It's an artist with a story he's passionate about that he has made with a cinematographer who is committed to a certain aesthetic of realism that is not going to butter anything up for us. It's going to ask us to sort through all of the tough moral questions, and we can't even decide halfway through who we admire.
But now at distribution. Somebody brings this movie to distribution and says, we want this to be distributed in the United States.
Well, I think the excellence of it and the critical acclaim for it tells them that they will find an audience in art house theaters. And because another film made by the same cinematographer, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu, last year, won awards all over the place, I think they knew they were onto something good.
Okay.
And that's the part of me that objects to the movie itself philosophically, and where I differ from a lot of my colleagues, is that I do believe that anybody that accepts money to make a film is, in essence, entering into an agreement to make entertainment at some level. Unless you're doing it with your own money and have no intentions ever to distribute it anywhere for anybody else to see, it might happen. But if you go into it saying, yes, I'm going to make this film and we're going to show it to people, then it does, at some level, I believe, have an obligation to be entertaining. And I don't think this is a film that's aiming to be entertaining. The director has said that in essence, he saw it as an opportunity because of the way his financing was arranged to make an art film and make it the way he wanted. Hmm. More power to him. We don't have that luxury here in the United States. But also, this is not the kind of film we go to for entertainment in the United States either. But which is not a bad thing. I mean,
I applaud any artist that asks us to revise our definition of entertainment.
Sure, absolutely.
I mean, I was incredibly entertained by it in that my mind was just running on all cylinders while I was watching it, because the main character looks to be someone who will lay down her life for her friend, and shouldn't we applaud that? But then when you realize why she's laying her life down for her friend, what she's paying for out of support for a very irresponsible woman, it's painful. And in the end, when she's looking in the mirror for the third or fourth time trying to reconcile with her own moral or immoral decisions and the guilt she's going to carry for the rest of her life, I think the film asks very important questions about is there a time when supporting your friend is not the right thing to do? So I'm glad that they're challenging us to be entertained by something that isn't sensationalized or
glib.
Or glamorized in any way.
Well, speaking of entertainment, we just did a show with Jeff Kuse and Nigel Goodwin on U2, The Bonification of Christianity. And there was actually a group of people at that show that wanted to make sure we were going to complete our show on time so they could go to the IMAX theater to see the U2 in 3D. Jeff, what can you tell us about it?
Well, U2 has always been on the cutting edge of concert filmmaking. When Rattle and Hum opened at the peak of their popularity after the Joshua Tree was released, we saw things on the big screen we'd never seen in a concert film before. It really captured the energy of their concerts unlike anything else. Since then, they've always sought to be on that cutting edge. And of course, when they released the Vertigo single with the iPod ads, a lot of people thought they'd sold out yet again. But that was an innovative piece of video. Now, once again, they're on the cutting edge with a new kind of 3D that we've never seen before, filmed with these incredibly powerful cameras, and more of them than have ever been used in a 3D movie before, in this incredible arena for a concert with 10,000 screaming, joyful fans. And the 3D is really the reason to see it. But then secondly, I'd say they play an incredible show. They always play incredible shows, in my opinion, but this was something really special. Even the songs they've worn out, they did special things with here. But the 3D takes you so deeply into the experience that you're jumping when fans climb up on each other's shoulders, and you actually think that's somebody in the row in front of you climbing up on somebody's shoulders. And it takes away the layered effect of 3D so that you really feel a wraparound effect. And some of the most exhilarating moments in the movie are not about the band at all. They're just drifting over this crowd of people that are jumping up and down in unison, and it's like you're flying over the ocean. It's almost like this would have been more appropriate for the Elevation tour when they opened with that song, Elevation, because that's exactly what it feels like. You're in the front row at this great show, but then you have wings, and you can soar around the stage and drift down next to Larry Mullen Jr.'s drum set and study the details of that. It gives you the feeling of what it's like to be on stage, so that when Bono walks up to the camera and reaches out his hand, everybody jumps a little bit because they think he's going to touch their faces.
What do you think, Greg?
Well, that's absolutely right, I am one that is always behind the curve. It seems like I am always way too late to get on board of big things. I never watched Seinfeld, for instance. I was a big cynic about U2 from the word go, and I have long been a 3D snob that has just always said, what's the point exactly? Because sure, it's technology, but it's not fun and it's not effective. And I was absolutely blown away by this film. I sat down with my chip on my shoulder and had it knocked off within 10 minutes.
Wow.
Not only because of U2, but because of the technology and the execution. This is a well-designed film, well-executed, incredibly entertaining, and one that you literally can feel great taking your whole family to.
And meaningful.
This
is like a multiple simultaneous conversion.
Oh, yeah.
U2, 3D, I mean, the whole thing. Greg's a new man.
Yep.
He finally got it right.
Yeah.
Greg Wright.
The lenses have been peeled off, and now I can see.
It's going to be really interesting what happens when James Cameron shows us what he's doing with this technology, with his big sci-fi epic. It's been like 10 years in the making, called Avatar.
Wow.
That's going to be a breakthrough, I think.
Well, now we move from those films that are in the theaters right now to DVD releases, and we start with 310 to Yuma. Jenny?
310 to Yuma is one that was we didn't catch when it was out in the theaters, but there was a lot of buzz about, and is in this sort of slate of westerns or movies that are about the West that have come out. You've got Assassination of Jesse James, you've got No Country for Old Men, these movies dealing with the West. And 310 to Yuma is a little bit more classic in that genre. And it's about basically Christian Bale's character owes some money to a big mean guy, and he's got to get some money. And Russell Crowe's a, you know, robbery, robs stagecoaches. And he has to, it winds up that Christian Bale has to get Russell Crowe to the 310 train to Yuma, and he'll get a bunch of money from the government if he does this. And that's basically the plot of the film. And what struck me about this film is the different reactions that people have when they saw it. I watched it with my husband. He absolutely hated it. He hated the ending. He thought it was frivolous and ridiculous and illogical. And then I also talked to some other people who actually on the plane saw it, and they were just dumbstruck. Just, oh, one of the best movies I've ever seen. And so it's fascinating to me to see how you either love or hate this movie. You kind of can't be in between on it.
Greg, what do you think?
Well,
I saw your thumbs up and thumbs down in the background when the different crowd reactions of Jenny were mentioned.
I am a big fan of Westerns. It's my favorite genre. And I could, you know, sit here and talk to you. We could do a whole show on Westerns sometime, in fact. But I felt
could
watching
this. Could we all wear cowboy boots? And
we could.
Could we have Trigger, the horse, in the background?
I could bring all the gear, too, and the reenactor's gear and all that. No, but anyway, I felt watching this like I was watching Kevin Reynolds' Robin Hood turned into a Western, because I really feel like there were two movies going on here and two performances. Christian Bale in the central role as Dan, what's his name? That was good, wasn't it?
All of us are.
Dan. Good old Dan.
Well, I got my notes here. I can tell you exactly who it is. He played Dan Evans, of course, former governor of Washington State. But
which is another third element of the movie that was going awry.
Very serious performance, very intense performance, very realistic performance. And then you have the whole subplot with Russell Crowe's gang of thieves. Ben Wade is the character he plays, and then Ben Foster plays his sidekick, Charlie Prince. And these are scenery-chewing stereotypes of the highest order, and it just felt schizophrenic to me. Now, it does a great job of delivering certain ideas about certain themes of respect, familial bonding, the respect that fathers have for sons and sons have for fathers, and how that all gets worked out in kind of a media frenzy society. But I didn't feel it justified being a Western. It could have done it much more effectively in a contemporary setting.
Interesting.
If that's what it wanted to be about.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it for the performances. I guess I wasn't expecting anything but a big, showy Hollywood Western. And I was so surprised by Christian Bale's performance. Bale has sort of made a career of pushing himself to extremes to impress us that he really is an actor, because he became famous as a child actor in Empire of the Sun. And I think he's more than than earned our respect. It was so nice to see him sort of relax into a part. I mean, not that this is a relaxed character, but there were moments of warmth and humor in his character, and I felt like he finally found a three-dimensional character, maybe for the first time since Empire of the Sun.
Yeah.
And I just so enjoyed watching that sort of maturity, and I think it's going to make the next Batman film with him very interesting. Ben Foster makes a great villain, too, and it was nice to see Russell Crowe sort of step back and let some other actors have a moment.
Adam's Apple was a film that hit the indie film circuit big time, and a lot of people were talking about it, and now it's out on DVD. Jeff, what can you tell us about Adam's Apple?
Well, very few people know about this movie. It's available thanks to Film Movement, and it's been making the festival circuit here and there for a couple of years. But Danish writer and director Anders Thomas Jensen made this film in 2005. Adam's Apples is about a neo-Nazi who gets out of jail and he's sentenced to community service at this rural church where a vicar named Ivan has a very distinct way of sort of rehabilitating criminals. So he takes this neo-Nazi who is not in any way turned against his turned away from his nasty ideologies, and the vicar decides he's going to reform this guy. So everybody in this little camp, all these prisoners, have been given tasks to accomplish, tasks that will help them sort of find stability, hopefully. So Adam, the neo-Nazi, cynically decides that he is going to bake a pie with the apples that are abundant in this tree. He figures, well, that's easy enough. The story then takes a very interesting twist as God gets involved. It seems that the vicar and God have this connection where God is going to discourage Adam from accomplishing this very simple task.
Okay.
And things start happening to that tree that you wouldn't believe to prevent him from baking a simple pie. On top of that, though, the vicar's devotion to God is a little suspect, too, because he is denying obvious things. He denies the fact that his son is disabled, for example. Then we meet his son, and his son could not be more disabled. He seems to just disregard the violence that's taking place right there at the camp. And the neo-Nazi, Adam, just keeps beating the snot out of this vicar, and his face becomes this punching bag that keeps swelling in different ways over the course of the film till he's almost unrecognizable, and it's hilarious. So the film becomes this interesting, cynical comedy. And you're not sure whether it's going to come down on the side of faith in God or on the side of the neo-Nazi. And I just found it delightful, unpredictable, dark, and twisted.
So what if we were doing a theology of film discussion, I mean, where did you end up coming out in terms of what his theological point was?
Well, I think he is having a lot of fun at the expense of the neo-Nazi. But even though he is exaggerating the sufferings of the vicar, I do think faith comes off looking pretty good in the end. I mean, the resilience of this punching bag of a cleric really does win out, I think, in the end, as you see characters start to find some common bonds together and start to believe that maybe there is a better way. But boy, it's a rough road to get there.
Jenny?
Definitely, I'd agree. It's Jeff recommended that I see it for the show, and halfway through I'm thinking, why am I watching this movie? But no, it really does wind up being delightful in sort of a dark way and really does come, I think, down on the side of faith. The vicar says over and over again, God is on my side. It doesn't matter what you do to me, God is on my side and you're going to lose, says this to the neo-Nazi all the time. And that type of a faith, even in the midst of horrors, is such a blessed thing to see. And the book of Job plays a role in this movie as well, and it is very Jobian in that sense of the Lord gives and takes away. Blessed be the Lord.
Hmm. Speaking of the Lord, we got another God movie that has God in the title. God Grew Tired of Us is now out on DVD. Greg, what can you tell us about this one?
Well, it's an interesting one to follow up Adam's Apples with because it takes a rather more pessimistic view of God and his involvement in things. The line, God grew tired of us, is taken from one of the central characters in the film, John Boldow, who is one of three of Sudan's lost boys that the film follows. It's a documentary. It's not just a true story, but it is the true story of these three men who, after some 14 years in refugee camps in both Sudan and Kenya, find their way through a relocation program to the United States and have to not only learn how to adapt to entirely different ways of living, but learn to come to grips with the fact that they were the survivors. And not only were they survivors, but they were the ones who were lucky enough to leave the camps and go on to a new life. And at one point, John comes to the conclusion, and this is in America, not back in the camps of Kenya, where he actually felt more secure. He actually comes to the conclusion that somehow God has grown tired of them and no longer cares. In part because of the problems of adjusting to a new society that lives by very different rules, but also because of the tendency in the West to think, well, now that we've done something for them, we can stop caring about them.
Yeah.
We've fulfilled our part. They're okay. Wow. They're here. They're among us. We don't need to follow up anymore. And the fact is that assimilation is a very, very difficult thing for people coming to the United States as a refugee. It's a very different thing when you've prepared yourself to go pursue the American dream. It's a very different thing to find yourself plopped into the middle of it when, in fact, you were more at home in Kenya amongst the people that you know, even though you were in destitute poverty.
Wow. Jenny, what do you say?
Well, this movie hits home for me right now because I literally have two non-English-speaking refugees in my house at the moment, part of this relocation programs that they do. And the movie is discouraging, but also, in a sense, encouraging, because there are some successes in the film. Some of the boys do reach a point of, you know, quote-unquote, American success, going on to college and these sorts of things, getting education, getting a job. But it really is hard, and I think Greg is right when he says we sort of give our 6 months of let's do our good deed by these people and then forget about them, and to have to learn a trade, learn to speak a language, especially here, is so hard. And I think the movie helps us remember that the least of these are among us all around, and we just need to be aware of that and compassionate.
Yeah, there are some delightfully funny moments along the way, though. I love the moment when they're checking out their new kitchen and they can't get past the light switch because they've never seen one of these before. They get into the kitchen and they pick up a liter of Pepsi, and one of them turns to the camera and says, "We have this where I come from, but we call it Coca-Cola."
Wow. Well, you know, that's this is another one of those films that everybody ought to see who says that they're interested in compassion, because this actually asks, you know, who's growing tired here? Is it God or the people who call themselves the followers of God?
Yeah.
And so it's that's God grew tired of us. Now we turn to the portion of the show where each of our esteemed colleagues choose a film that we probably haven't seen or may never have even heard of, and they take on the Herculean task of convincing us with all of our film options out there that this is one we really ought to see. And we start with Jenny and Beyond the Gates.
Beyond the Gates is a film, another film about Rwanda. And if there were no Hotel Rwanda, this would be the quintessential Rwandan film that everyone should have seen. It is about a small camp where the UN, a small contingent of UN soldiers are there to watch the peacekeeping and basically do nothing. But they're encamped at a church, at a Catholic church and school. And so the children of the neighborhood come to the school every day and learn sports and learn Bible lessons and all these things. And there's an elder priest and then a younger, I don't know if he's a seminarian or a missionary. And it's based on a true story of this camp in Rwanda. And why I think it is the quintessential Rwandan film is because it shows the true struggle when you're in the midst of hell. What do you do? What is your faith going to do? How are you going to react in literally the face of your own death, the death of your friends, family, people you've come to care about? Will you save your own skin? Or will you stay? These are some of the questions that this film asks in a really poetic and beautiful way, rather than a hit you over the head with a hammer type of a thing, which I think is a great question to ask, but also a beautiful tribute to the lives that were lost there.
Beyond the Gates, it's not a film of Microsoft after Bill Gates. It is. It is a film about Rwanda. Spiderwick Chronicles, Greg.
Well, this is not a great film by any means.
You're in a surly mood today.
Well, no, this.
I don't think the words "gotta see" has come out of his mouth. We're now in the category of must see, and it opens with "this is not a great film."
Well, this is my pick, and I will explain my pick, and this is why I think people should see this.
Okay.
Even though it's not a particularly good film. In fact, I, in my review, I called it a mix of Spielbergian narrative over efficiency and no mobile sprightliness.
Oh my gosh.
So it goes by way too fast. But this is the thing that it does right. The central story is about twin boys who move into a house and discover that they're being beset by an army of goblins. The thing that it does right is it doesn't turn goblins into the Lord of the Rings orcs, or the Uruk-hai, which is even, if you know your mythology of orcs and goblins and the Lord of the Rings, you have goblins, you have orcs, and you have the Uruk-hai. Well, the trend lately in fantasy films is to turn everything into the Uruk-hai, to make everything as dark and demonic as possible. Mm-hmm. This film did not make that mistake. It is a film for children, and the goblins are goblins as they were intended to be thought of, which is, yes, they're evil, yes, they're monsters, yes, they're your enemies, but they're also kind of, I don't know, quaint. They're also kind of dopey, you know, like Abbott and Costello-ish or something like that. So they're to be feared, yes, but not taken terribly seriously. And this is important because there's another little film project that's going to be coming out in a couple of years called The Hobbit, which is a story that featured goblins.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important, hopefully, that audiences will expect something more along the lines of the Spiderwick Chronicles than the Lord of the Rings out of this film. And hopefully the makers of the film, too, will do that. Now, Peter Jackson has signed on to executive produce the film, and it is going to go forward in spite of the fact that New Line Cinema now has been folded into Warner Brothers. They have not yet settled on the director, but hopefully the director will have the good sense to realize The Hobbit is not the dark story that The Lord of the Rings was, and to make it a lighter, to direct the film with a lighter touch, and to have a vision that's more of a child peeking through their fingers, in which you don't see things as they are, you see things as you're frightened of them. And the goblins in the Hobbit do not need to be demonic. They need to be the goblin-esque characters of the Spiderwick Chronicles.
Yeah, there you go. Spiderwick
and we can enjoy Chronicles. That. That's a different kind of fear.
And Jeff brings us Paprika.
Well, if you've discovered Hayao Miyazaki, as many Americans have, thanks to Pixar and Disney for distributing Spirited Away a few years back, which won the Best Animated Feature Oscar. Then you probably have an appetite for the visual splendor of that kind of animation, and maybe you're adjusting to the stylistic differences of Japanese animation. Well, due to director Satoshi Kon's imagination, we now have Paprika, and it is every bit as visually amazing as Spirited Away, but it's a movie for grown-ups far more than Spirited Away was. In fact, I would say, even though it's a cartoon, don't sit down to watch this one with your kids, because it's dealing with very grown-up issues, so to speak. It's about a Japanese research psychotherapist named Dr. Chiba. It's a very attractive woman who sits down with her patients and talks about their dreams, and then they go to sleep, and she sort of puts on her superhero guise and dives into their dreams through this new technology, this little device called a DC Mini, which allows her to explore their dreams and understand them better. Well, the technology gets stolen, of course. And now people are invading each other's dreams and mixing them up and broadcasting one person's dreams into another person's head until the dream world becomes so confused that the people in the dreams don't even know how to wake up anymore, and the people in the real world aren't too sure if they're in the real world anymore. And so people will...
In short, the way most of us feel on a given month.
Yes, yes. And
I'm living someone else's dream right now.
There are little commentaries, little comments all the way through that suggest that this is what the world is becoming thanks to the internet.
Yeah.
With Second Life and with...
Interesting.
The way that media is saturating the real world everywhere we turn, we are confronted with other people's dreams and pursuing our own all the time. Now, where it gets really interesting is when we start to realize how much American imagination is appearing in these Japanese dreams.
Oh, my gosh.
And in a sense, you start to get this idea that there's a stealth warfare going on. World War III or IV, maybe, is what we're at now, is actually happening on the internet or in the movies as... Dr. Chiba, or Paprika, as she's known in the dream world, starts to see these parades of American icons moving down the street. There's a sense that the U.S., with all of its media, is invading Japan.
Yes.
And there's one very interesting character who's sort of a techie who just loves all media and all movies. He actually says, "I swallow everything." And that itself is a comment on the those who indulge in movies and media without any discernment. And so while the film is a critique of media and the internet and the saturation of our culture, it's also an affirmation of the power of dreams and the beauty of movie making. And it ends on such a beautifully optimistic note, and I'll leave that for you to discover.
Amazing. Well, we've hit another series of interesting sounding films on the Kindling's Muse at the Movies. Those in the theaters are The Other Boleyn Girl, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, U2 in 3D. The ones that we mentioned that are out now on DVD are 310 to Yuma, Adam's Apple, and God Grew Tired of Us. And the picks this time are Beyond the Gates, Spiderwick Chronicles, and Paprika. This is Dick Staub. Thanks for joining us on the Kindling's Muse at the Movies. Again, our guests have been Jeffrey Overstreet, Jenny Spohr, and Greg White. Remember, you can join the conversation at thekindlings.com. We'll look forward to seeing you next time.